In the Freeway Guide to Personal Finance, we talked a lot about credit scores and how important having a good credit score is to your long-term financial plan. We went over a number of ways of getting your score up, but there is another really cool way to improve your credit score, especially if you have no credit history whatsoever. What I'm talking about here is becoming an authorized user on someone else's account. See, when you become an authorized user, basically you inherit that person's good credit history. Two bits of caution here, though. One is that you should not become an authorized user on anyone's credit card unless they have a credit score above 700. If their credit score is terrible, you will inherit their terrible score. So be sure the person making you the authorized user knows they have good credit. The second bit of advice is for the generous person willing to make you an authorized user. Oftentimes, this is done between parents and children or between spouses. When I do my presentations for parents of high school and college students, this whole authorized user thing goes over like a sack of bricks, and I can see why. But what people don't realize is that your new authorized user doesn't have to use the card in order to inherit your good credit. If I made you an authorized user on my account, relax, I won't do it, then a card would come in the mail with your name on it. And I could, if I wanted to, rip that card up. So you never use it, see it, or touch it. But the instant I called and said, make so-and-so an authorized user, your score will go up. Use this authorized user trick carefully, though. Once you do it, you are connected to the person who gave the authorization. If they start paying late, that will show up on your report as well. My theory is that you do this to get someone enough of a credit score so they can get their own credit card, then remove them as an authorized user. I'm not a big fan of intertwining financial lives any more than necessary. So when using the authorized user trick, get on, then get off. You've already listened to the Freeway Guide to Personal Finance, and that should get you started on the path to financial success. But at some point in your financial life, you should get some help from a living and breathing financial advisor. So let me tell you briefly about financial advisors and how to find a good one. First of all, there are two types of financial advisors that I think we all need to have. One is a legal advisor or lawyer, and the other is a tax advisor. Both the legal code and the tax code change every year, and you need a professional to help guide you through these realms of the financial world. We're not going to get into them here because it's a bit complicated and things do vary from state to state. But it is worth your time to ask friends and family who they use to help them with their legal and tax affairs. The legal code and the tax code offer a score of ways for you to save money and protect your assets, but only if you have an expert guide. If you want an additional advisor to help you choose the right insurance policy, create an investment portfolio, or help you gauge how much house you can afford, then there is a great way to sort through the dozens of financial advisors hanging their shingle in your town. Some financial advisors get paid only when you buy something. These folks might be called commission-based advisors, or in layman's terms, a salesperson. Others charge a flat fee regardless of whether you buy something or not. These are called fee-only advisors. Still others combine flat fees with commission-based sales. These people are called fee-based advisors. My advice is to start with a fee-only advisor. I say this because fee-only advisors are the only people who will objectively look at your entire financial life. Your real estate broker won't comment on your credit card debt. Your stockbroker won't bring up disability insurance. But a fee-only advisor will look at everything. I don't want you to ever confuse a fee-only advisor with a fee-based advisor. Remember, fee-only advisors, this is what I am, by the way, do not make any money from recommending specific products. You pay a fee-only advisor a flat fee, and then they tell you what they think. If you follow their advice, they don't make any more money. If you don't follow their advice, they don't make any more money. As you can see, fee-only advisors are often the most unbiased because they won't get any richer off you once you have paid their fee. Fee-only advisors are good for helping you determine the right insurance, the right legal structure for your financial plan, and developing a strategy to minimize taxes. In my opinion, everyone, and yes, I do mean everyone, should make it a goal to meet with a fee-only advisor at least once. It's also my opinion that everybody should make it a goal to meet with a lawyer at least once to discuss the legal aspects of your financial plan. I also think you should make it a part of your plan to meet with a tax professional at least once per year, as the tax code is something that keeps changing year after year. If you follow the advice in the Freeway Guide to Personal Finance, there won't be an urgent need to find a fee-only financial advisor. You will need to find a tax and legal advisor. But it is important to know that you will come across these advisors and that fee-only advisors can guide you through the nitty-gritty, totally boring stuff like picking the right disability insurance policy. There's this common misconception that financial advisors will have the answers about what the next hot stock is. This is not what fee-only advisors do. So it is important to remember that this kind of investment advice is not what you should be looking to your financial advisor for. In the Freeway Guide to Personal Finance, we spend a lot of time talking about investing. And often people spend a lot of time worrying about how do you buy at the bottom and sell at the top? This is tough to do. But one way you can ensure you will buy more at the bottom and less at the top is to incorporate an investment strategy known as dollar cost averaging. You already know from listening to the program that it's all about diversification. So let's just take it a little further here. One way to diversify is to buy many different investments, i.e. several different stocks in an index mutual fund. But another way to reach diversification is to buy at different times as opposed to all at once. Remember, we said the price of stocks fluctuate based on the demand of buyers and sellers. Just as there is a challenge to picking individual stocks, so too is there a challenge picking the perfect time to buy. Fortunately, the solution to both is the same. Just like we are going to buy every stock using an index mutual fund, so too are we going to buy all the time using dollar cost averaging. The mechanics of dollar cost averaging are easy. Pick an amount to invest every month or every quarter and invest that same amount every month or every quarter. When you do this, you will buy fewer shares of stock when the price is high and more shares when the price is low. Let's say you're investing $100 a month in, say, Dell Computer. You may buy only 2 shares when the price is at a high of $50 in July, but you might snatch up 5 shares when the price is at a low of $20 in September. As long as you keep investing the same amount of money, you'll consistently buy more at the bottom price and less at the top price. In the long run, this means more shares for less money. In the Freeway Guide to Personal Finance, you learned why owning your own home is so important to your long-term financial strategy. In order to buy real estate, let's face it, most everybody needs to take out a mortgage. These days, there are many kinds of mortgages available, but let's talk a bit about the type of loan that you should get. Back when your parents bought a house, there were only a handful of loans, and if you didn't qualify, well, then you were out of luck. Nowadays, there is a loan for everyone, even people who don't have a job. But just because a bank will offer you a loan doesn't mean you should take it. The most vanilla loan there is a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage with the borrower contributing 20% towards the price of the home. This means you put down 20% of the sales price and the bank gives you a loan for the remaining 80%. As vanilla as this loan is, very few people qualify for it anymore, especially first-time homebuyers. The reason is that with today's real estate prices, who can afford to come up with 20% of a $250,000 house? Very few people can save this much by the time they're ready to become homeowners. Adjustable rate mortgages, where the interest rate is fixed for a set number of years and then fluctuates, are becoming more popular because of rising real estate prices. People are scrambling for ways to lower their monthly payments, so they take on an adjustable rate with the plan of living in the property while the rate remains fixed and selling it before it starts to adjust. While this seems like a smart plan, there is a risk involved. What if you want to stay there longer? What if you can't sell your house for the price you were hoping for? Don't be too easily swayed by the initial lower interest rate these adjustables offer. If you can swing it, go with a fixed. If you can't, well, you may be borrowing above your head. Also, forget these interest-only loans. They're even worse than adjustables. With these loans, you don't pay down any of the loan. You just pay the interest for the first several years. And don't ever get a loan that is longer than 30 years. The 40-year mortgage has arrived. Well, actually, in Tokyo, it's been around for a while. But even if you follow my advice and get a fixed rate loan, how are you possibly supposed to come up with that 20% down payment? Well, the short answer is, you probably won't. You'll probably need to borrow more than 80% of the sales price. There are two basic ways to do this. One is to pay private mortgage insurance, or PMI. The other way is to get what is known as a blended mortgage. PMI protects the bank in the event that you don't pay your mortgage. PMI allows you to borrow more than 80% of the price of the property, but it is expensive because PMI is not deductible on your tax return, like mortgage interest typically is. But you can ask your mortgage broker if you can roll your PMI into the loan amount. Basically, you're financing the cost of private mortgage insurance and then making it deductible. If you can roll the cost of PMI into your loan, I'd say this is probably the best option. Doing this will give you a tax deduction, but it will also give you predictability. Your payments will never change. A blended mortgage is when you buy a house with not one, but two loans. You have one loan for 80% and one loan to help you contribute to the down payment. That second loan can be anywhere from 5 to 20%. So if you have a blended mortgage with one loan being 80% of the price and another loan being 20% of the price, you could literally buy a house without putting any money down. Often the interest rates on the smaller second loan in a blended mortgage can be quite high, or if they are at a decent rate, they're going to be adjustable. So be careful. Often simply rolling the cost of PMI into the loan makes the most sense. Still, blended mortgages are an option for people who can't afford to cough up the 20%, which is rapidly becoming everyone. And because you have two mortgages, all the interest that you pay on both mortgages becomes deductible. My general advice is to follow the golden rule as best you can. Remember that golden rule: borrow as little as possible, at the lowest interest rate possible, for the shortest time period possible. Put down as much as you can, up to 20%. If you can afford a 15-year mortgage instead of a 30-year mortgage, then go for it. If you can afford a 25-year mortgage instead of a 30-year mortgage, then go for it. And shop around and follow the steps to get your credit score up so you can ensure you get the best interest rate possible. In the Freeway Guide to Personal Finance, most of what we talked about had to do with planning your own personal financial future. But as many of you either have or will someday have kids, let's talk about saving for your kids' college. Here's the interesting thing about saving for college. Most parents and grandparents are saving for college the wrong way. Even more interesting, most parents and grandparents shouldn't be saving for college at all. The sad truth about college savings is that the more you save, the less financial aid you are likely to get. Imagine two kids who are neighbors, both the same age, both work at the same fast food restaurant. Susie saves all of her money at the restaurant in a bank account, and by the time college rolls around, she has $12,000 in there. Bobby put the money he earned into buying a car. He literally saved nothing. Both apply for financial aid at the same college. Both their parents make the exact same amount of money. But you can guess who gets more financial aid. Bobby will get more aid because in the college's eyes, his net worth is far lower than Susie's. The college will ask Susie to contribute about $4,500 of that $12,000 she saved towards college. Her financial aid package, therefore, will be based on the fact that she can pay the first $4,500 of expenses herself. However, the college will not ask Bobby to sell his car. They are unlikely to even ask if he has a car. They will look at his net worth and assume he cannot contribute anything himself, so he will probably get more financial aid than Susie. Rather than save for college in some sort of college savings account, I would prefer parents pay down home equity, max out their retirement accounts, or even pay off a car loan. Doing these things will increase your net worth, but shouldn't jeopardize your chances at getting financial aid. And if your child is just about ready for college, consider cleaning out some of the money in your bank account or theirs to purchase certain items. In other words, it is better for your child to buy a computer now and then apply for financial aid than it is to apply for financial aid and then buy the computer. Cash in a bank account will affect the financial aid calculations. The computer will not. Another big mistake parents and grandparents make is that they save money in the child's name. They do this primarily because they want that feeling of giving. But while this may feel good in the short run, it will hurt in the long run when you're asked to cough up a lot more money for that tuition bill. Colleges will ask that 35 cents of every dollar in the child's name be contributed towards tuition. But colleges will only ask for 5 cents of every dollar in the parent's name. So if you can, set aside your desire to give to your child and keep as much money as you can in your own name. Many people think that they make too much money to apply for financial aid, and this is absolute garbage. Everyone, and yes, everyone, should apply for financial aid. It cannot hurt to try. And if college is several years away for your child, think about how fast college tuition is going up. As I write this audio program, I don't have any children. But by the time my children go to college, I wouldn't be surprised if I had to fork over $100,000 a year per child to pay for tuition. Maybe I'll just get a dog. For most people, your best college saving strategy is not to do it at all, and instead funnel the money into other vehicles. Pay down your home equity, wipe out your credit card and car loan debt, and stuff as much money as you are legally allowed into your retirement accounts. When the time comes, apply for financial aid and see what you get. If the number comes up short, then you'll probably have to borrow a lot of money to pay for college. But in my opinion, that's okay. The interest rates on college loans are often quite low, and they often do not require any collateral to get them. And if you have been saving properly in the other vehicles I recommended, you can always get more cash to pay for college by just cutting back on extra mortgage payments or retirement account contributions. If your cash flow is such that you have truly exhausted these other options, it may make sense to meet with a fee-only financial advisor about the best way to save for college. Aside from the advice I have already given, college savings is not all that cookie-cutter like retirement savings. But most people would do well simply by putting college savings at the bottom of the priority ladder.